Do you mind me admitting that I am just a tad bit uncomfortable? We've heard a lot of talk and a lot of discussion about the past. And I don't know that it occurred to me that I had agreed to such a ridiculous thing to talk about. A vision for the future anchored in the past. Brother Marcus, I really appreciated what he had to say. He did let us at a difficult place. If you look in your booklet, if you have them, you'll see that he has us assimilated. The last word he used in his graph was assimilation. I can understand that, Marcus, and I can understand where you're going, but I did wonder, how can we get us out of that tight spot? Is that really where we're at? And then this allegory, Brother Scott. Just a few observations maybe to help us think about that. It occurred to me that maybe there's a few saving things in the allegory. All of the ships were saving people out of the water, from what I could tell in the allegory. He didn't tell us if that westward movement was toward heaven, or what that westward movement just actually represented. I took that he probably intended that to mean that it was a fairly, I don't know, sort of the right direction. But he didn't say so. I was hoping he would. So I don't know. It feels to me as though these brothers have just left me stuck here to talk about where this is all headed. Are these ships sinking? Are they headed in right directions? Are they really saving people out of the water? Is that really what's happening? What is happening? I sure hope you've been praying, because I wonder where we'll go here. My intention is to be rather on the positive side, and I'm very well aware of that. I know I tend to be just a little bit that way to begin with. So I don't intend to make a lot of negative remarks about where we're at and where we're about ready to drop off. I just want to say to begin with, though, I'm not foolish, and my eyes aren't closed, and it's not like I don't know that there are some really serious difficulties that we're facing. And we'll probably touch on a few of those. But I hope to give us a little bit of an idea about some of the things that we should pay attention to as we step forward. I'm not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet. And so I don't take the words to be prophetic so much as to be, as to help us to think about where we're at and where we're headed. If you notice in your booklet, I have a number of verses from the Sermon on the Mount, and I found this fascinating that Brother Etzel brought to our attention Peter Burkholder's 9 reflections that come from the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and kind of walks us through what we call the Beatitudes. And I'm not that familiar with what Peter said about that, but I took it that he viewed this as a path to salvation, so to speak, a path that Christian people ought to take. The verses that I chose before I knew what Brother Etzel was going to say to start off with in this discussion are these verses that come right on the heels of those of the Beatitudes. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick. And it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Just a few comments here. If in fact Peter Burkholder is right, and I somewhat agree, the characteristics that are laid out in the Beatitudes are the characteristics that apply here. So when it says, ye are the salt of the earth, we're talking about those people who have in fact experienced that movement from becoming poor in spirit and mourning over our sins and learning what it means to be merciful, etc., etc. Those things. Ye are the salt of the earth. Secondly, ye are the light of the world. Going along with that idea. Of course, please note this. But if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? I would like to lay claim for the conservative Mennonite church that we are at least a part of that saltiness that is on the earth. But there is a question here, and that question is worth thinking about. But if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? What will happen to this old earth if the salt hath lost its savor? And the question is, in all these ships wandering around out there in the ocean, well, just how salty is it, or how capable of participating in the salvation of people? I note just a few other things here that seem to be overlooked so often. When it says that you're the light of the world and a city that's set on a hill cannot be hid, it goes on down here to say something that we don't like to look at this verse for some reason. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. Now, I know this is a little bit dangerous, but I want to say it for whatever it's worth. We have been so cowed in our day by all of the rhetoric that goes along with the idea that, you know, salvation is not by works, on and on and on and on. Well, I agree with that. But there are verses in the Bible that emphasize something else. It does infer here that there will be a connection between salvation and ethics, as has been argued already correctly. That's clearly there. And not only that, it says you should not be ashamed of that position. You are salt and you are light, and let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. I get weary of all of the talk that tries to, always throwing water on the idea that the Christian community ought to visibly be salt and light. It should be experiential in this earth. And we are instructed to, in fact, let that shine. Let it be shown across the earth. And this morning, I just want to begin by saying, the future, let your light so shine that men may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Which, of course, is the point. That leads us to a key question. This is a very important question in my mind. I have just a few blanks in your book, and I'm going to give you another metaphor here to think about. The question that I have for us is this. What is our niche in the ecology of the kingdom? Now, this is a very, very important question. And it's loaded with some inferences that I surely do want you to understand what those inferences are about. I have highlighted here a few words just to be sure that you understand where I'm headed here. I think some of our problem over the years has been a misunderstanding of what's alluded to in this question. First of all, there is an ecology of the kingdom. You know what ecology is about? I realize that that word is not in the Bible. And I know there are some people who think if a word is not in the Bible, it's not a very useful word. Well, I don't agree. The word ecology is, of course, a biological term. And if I had here a piece of sod, if I had gone out here and cut out a square foot of sod and brought it in here with the soil and the weeds and the bacteria and the grass and the rocks and the stones and the minerals and all of the other things that make up that piece of sod, I would have a little ecological system, a life-giving system. And when we study ecology, what we study is, what is it about that little square of sod that makes it uniquely alive and living? And I'm suggesting to you that there is an ecology of the kingdom. Now, the reason I say it that way is because when you look at all these ships out there floating around on that water, and you think about, if you followed my reasoning, they're all out there gathering up a few people out of the ocean and getting them in the boat. Now, don't misunderstand me to say that I think that all of the ships that are out there on the sea representing various churches and denominations and this and that and the other thing are doing the right things. I'm not trying to suggest that. But I am suggesting that we had better write into our theology that we are not the only ones on the face of the earth who are doing the will of God. I don't believe that. I believe there are many people. God has called out many people on the face of the earth to bring about his purposes on the face of the earth. And when I begin to understand that, I'm not so quick to find fault with the ship that is off to my left or to my right or wherever it is who is out there busily filling their place in that chunk of sod, in that ecology of the kingdom. They're doing their work. So I'm begging us to remember that this is a model to think about, that there are other people beyond the Anabaptist people. I'm going to say it that strongly. There are other people who are in fact, also have boats on the water. And they're out there doing a work. Let's not, when we talk about our history, be so sure that we are the only ones. Now, having said that, I want you to go back to the other word now. The word is niche. In that piece of sod that I was talking about, each little bacterium, from the bacterium to the roots to the plants to the soil to the minerals, what they each have their niche. They have their place of service in the ecology of that kingdom. And now I am going to suggest to you, we do have a place to stand in the kingdom of God. I hope you understand what I'm trying to do here. On one side, I'm trying to say to you, there is no reason for us to think that we are so exclusively wonderful that we end up being very proud and arrogant that we are the people of God. On the other side, I am saying there is dignity in our position. We do have a niche. We do have a place in the kingdom. And I hope by the time I'm finished, I can help you to understand where at least I think that place is. And I want us to understand that for my part, I'm not ashamed of the niche that we have. I'm not ashamed of the part that we play in the kingdom of God. And we need to turn away from the shame that I have heard people talk about and act as if for some reason we are so antiquated and so out of place and so out of it and so not, we're just not up with the times and so forth that we hardly are relevant anymore. That's a lie. I will guarantee you, as sure as I'm standing here, that's a lie. We are very relevant. We do have a niche. We do have a place to stand. And the little bit of experience I've had, both here in the United States, working in our churches, working in the prisons, and also working in some international missions across the water and so forth, this has become clearer to me. You're not going to persuade me that we don't have a place to stand. And that's really what I want to talk about this morning. I want us not, whatever we do in the future, let's quit this being ashamed of the place God has given us. And let's quit this backing out and cowering before all of the rhetoric that we hear that makes it look as though we're somehow irrelevant to the day. It's not true. Well, what is our niche? I want to talk about that for a little bit. Second point is, I believe that we have a niche of pastoral nurture. From what I can tell as I look across the spectrum of Christianity, without making big judgments about who's who and what's what, I'll go to the polls maybe and say it this way. I don't think that our groups are made of Billy Graham evangelism style work. I've already tried to cover the point that we're not here to get after Billy Graham and tell him he's doing the wrong thing. In fact, I'm not prepared to make a statement about it. Let him have his niche. I don't think it's ours. Ours is more pastoral. It has always been this way. It has been, always been the sense of roll up your sleeves, get down into the dirt, and work hard. Pay attention to the infrastructure. Pay attention to daily living. Pay attention to the things that make up life. Pastor, nurture, care for people, and so forth and so on. That pastoral nature I've broken down into three simple words. And I know I tend to be big picture and probably fairly simplistic for many. I hope you can bear with me on that. You're going to note immediately that I'm not saying anything really brand new to you today. I am simply talking about things that we've known before and trying to affirm us in them, I think, and give some projection about where we need to head. The first one, you probably can guess, one and two. Number one, I have family. I might put up here that here's 2003, and one of the things that we're expected to do today is talk about what we might want this to look like in 2050. Now, I just arbitrarily chose 2050. If I live to be to that till 2050, I'll be very close to 100 years old. Not quite, but getting there. So I don't know if I'll see this, but the question I ask you, and I ask this to the very young folks seated here, I ask you to consider this question. What do we really want this to look like in 2050? Now, I first of all am saying to you that one of the niches that we have held in the Christian community is we have done fairly well with our families. Now, I know about the problems. I know about the difficulties. I'm not trying to ignore them. But in contrast to the other niches that are being held by various Christian groups, we have done fairly well with family. And that's the reason that I raised this one here. The question is, what are we going to do? How are we going to project this? What's this going to look like? I'm going to, first of all, affirm what has happened in years gone by. Let's see, there's a book called Doing Good Better. So I'm not here to shout down what we have done in the past or to act like things have not gone well. In fact, I just want to say something here for whatever it's worth. I remember when I was about 20 years old thinking, you know, my dad's generation was just a little backward. Just to be real fair with you, like my father never sat down and talked to me about my sexuality and how this would all be worked out. And this all seemed very, you know, when I was a 20-year-older, I thought, well, he does, you know, we're progressing a little bit and we'll do a little bit better we'll do better in the next generation. And my father was not the kind of person who's going to sit down with you and have a very, very, very close discussion with you. He was not that kind of person. He's still living, by the way, 80 years old, just had a triple bypass. But he wasn't that kind of person. And I remember of reflecting and thinking rather negatively about some of those things that weren't quite the way they should be as a 20-year-older. Well, now I just want to say something. That generation did a lot of things right. They did a lot of things very, very well. I'll tell you why he didn't do that and why he probably didn't have to do it. So I was thinking about this morning. I remembered some of the memories that come back from those days. My dad had a little 8N Ford. We were farmers. And any of you have ever driven 8N Fords, you know, they're not all that big. And we used that little tractor to rake hay. So you'd go out to rake hay with this thing. Besides that, up here in my garage, there is a little Fords and Dexta. That's a little blue diesel tractor. And he had one of those, too. And the same kind of event would happen, and they would go out to rake hay. Just a little tot. Now, I know this is, I'm probably not teaching something good about safety right now, but, you know, Dad would take us along with him. And he'd set us right down in the seat, between his legs. Okay, when I was just, you can tell I've never been a big man. I wasn't a big boy either. You know, so it was very easy to sit right between his legs, and I could still feel the buttons off of his bib overalls, and my head would sort of start slouching around from getting sleepy, you know, bump, 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 around like this. And besides that, hear just the little gentle hum. My dad was not a musician. So it's just not like he went around singing the Hallelujah Chorus and things like that. But he did, he would, when we were driving the tractor, he would hum under his breath. And you could feel that rumble, you know. You're just bobbing around, you're half sleeping, and your ear against his bib overalls and these kinds of things. You just hear that, and you knew that all was well with the world. Now, my suggestion to you is this. He actually did know something about how to sit down and talk with people. So quite a bit different than what we're used to today. I'm just saying, let's not be looking backward and say, look, they didn't do so well. They actually, in my opinion, did really quite well. And maybe we're not doing as well as we think we are in this way. But let me just mention a few things that I think we had better make sure that are in place in 2050. Committed marriages. Brothers, we have had it right to stand strong on the issue of divorce and remarriage. After all of the discussion is in about the wording and this and that and the other thing, and after we have admitted that not all of our marriages are perfect, or even close to perfect, it still is true that when I stand up in the prison and say that our people do not divorce, they say, they what? You have no divorce in your church? Well, that's right. We have our troubles, but we believe in committed marriages. Now, there's a lot more to a committed marriage than just simply saying that we don't believe in divorce and remarriage. I know that. But let's begin by saying we're not going to open the door to that kind of thing. We're just not going to do that. Whatever the problems are, they're going to be solved another way, not that way. So for my part, I plan to work very, very hard to maintain committed marriages. Secondly, we need to continue to have a high view of motherhood. What I'm talking to you about today is nothing really, it is big. But it's talked about so often, and we think about it in some ways, that we pass it off and don't understand its profound importance. The niche that we hold in the Christian community today, now listen to me, ladies, I know they get on our case now and then for saying that we repress you ladies. I don't believe, well, we might sometimes, but in general, we don't do that. In general, we don't do that. I'm telling you, we give a much higher place to a mom who will bear 7 and care for them all of her years, of her adult years, and train them up in the ways of God and teach them how to do things. We do give a reasonably high place to that position, and if we do anything, we should make it higher, not lower. Need to have a high view of motherhood. Here's one maybe will bite a little bit. Dads at home. You know, I've heard a lot of talk in the past number of years that it's kind of a bad deal. You have these latchkey children, you know, the latchkey youngsters. And so when they come home from school or wherever and they get to the door, nobody's there. Mom's not there. So we're all over the mothers because they've gone out into the workplace and they're not at home when the children come home. I have a question for you. Are the dads there when the children leave in the morning? Now, before you run away with that question, I want you to consider it seriously. See, what has happened in our day, from what I can tell, as we have made the transition from an agrarian community to other kinds of communities, we have not thought so well about it. So oftentimes, there's a lot of our youngsters who are getting up in the morning, dad is not there, he's gone. Now, you're going to get on my case right away, so what else am I supposed to do? Well, I'm just going to say to you, those are the things we have to solve. Those are the things that we have to think about. And if we want our families to be strong in 2050, then we have to pay attention to those kind of things. That little guy sitting right here, my son, every night before he goes to bed, practically every night, I pray with him. I tuck him to bed, and this is what he asked me. This is his last question. Dad, will you get me up in the morning? Now, this will explain to you, Milo, why I like to go home at 7:30 when I have a meeting here at Faith Builders. I don't make it there every morning. But it tells me something about what it means to be a dad and to hold this niche that we have always held in the Christian community on Christian family. It shows to me the importance of being there when they get up. My point to you dads is, listen, don't you put this all on the mothers, this latchkey thing. Some of this, maybe a greater part of it, is our problem. Up and going and running hither and yon and doing this and that and the other thing, and we're not there. I suggest to you that if we start with the morning at least, if dad is there, maybe something would be a little bit different. I won't tift. Is that? That's just 11 o'clock, isn't it? Okay, thank you. All of a sudden, is that 12? The second word I have for you is the word farm. Family and farm. Now, I've already done some alluding to this, and already pointed out to you that in the past there has always been kind of a connection. My growing up years, it was about as natural as walking. Because when dad got up, we got up. He came over, knocked on our door, it was time to go do the milking. So we got up and went out and did the milking. And when the milking was finished, we came in. And when we came in, mom had breakfast prepared. And we sat down at the table, and the family had breakfast together. And after that, if school was going on, off we went to school. If it was summertime and there was work to be done, we did work. We went out and sweated and toiled and worked shoulder to shoulder with our dads. This was the way it was. Now, I'm not silly, and I'm not foolish. Not everybody in here is going to be able to farm. I know that. That was almost natural and instinctive in those days. But we had better learn how to transfer the same ideas across into whatever it is that we're going to send this direction from the farm. I'm telling you, there's going to be some differences here. I know that. I sense it within myself. I see my boys growing up, and few of you would know how frustrated I am about the fact that I'm scrambling to make the same thing happen in my family as I knew was happening, well, I didn't know at the time, but as I perceive was happening in my dad's family when I was growing up. And we're and maybe not paying enough attention to it. What are we going to do? I have a few suggestions for you. First of all, I really am quite opposed to jobs that are going to, I already stated this, I think you understand it, jobs and responsibilities that are going to take dads out of the home, as and let mom there to raise the youngsters. Now, I'm sorry, we have to be solidly opposed to that. My opinion is that we just need to do whatever we need to do to keep that from happening. Here's a couple of suggestions for you. Small business. If I misspell a few things and run them together here, don't worry, I'm nervous. A small business. Small family business. I strongly encourage that. No, we're not all going to be able to stay in farms. I think one of the brothers said that we came over here because of land. That was one of the reasons. Was that you, Marcus, I believe? We come over here because of land. Well, we run out of land. Either we just simply run out of it, there's not enough, or it's priced just out of reason. You can't farm it. So I know this is not going to be the way it always is, but listen, we've got brains. We're not stupid. Don't we have any innovative understanding at all? Can't we do something about this? Can't we think about it, and rather than send our men out on the road with a truck a week away and then a week back, don't we have enough intelligence to do something about that and give some direction about it? I'm not talking about a legalistic statement. I'm talking about just addressing the problem and saying, look, it doesn't matter if it's over-the-road trucking or what it is. It's not right for dad not to be there to raise the children alongside of mom. Okay? And I'm suggesting to you that at least one of the ways of doing that is to think in terms of creating small business. And many of you are doing that. I think that's very wise. I would much rather see that than some of these things that take us away. Secondly, let me suggest to you excellent craftsmanship. Our people have over the years been known, at least in general, to do very fine work. That should not be lost. The work should be of outstanding quality. One of the reasons I suggest this to you is because this is well respected by people, and it gives you opportunity again to do something within the confines of your household alongside of your sons. Mark Sukup, he's not here this morning, but Kaya, his daughter, is, makes these Windsor chairs. Windsor rocking chairs, and they're bought all over the eastern United States here, from what I can understand. They're pretty expensive. The reason they're pretty expensive is it is outstanding workmanship. It is the kind of thing that a person then can do in the confines of his home, bless his family, be there, and so forth. You can dream on from there. We have become engaged in some other things that I think are very, very, very important. I'm going to talk just a little bit about at least the semi-professional world. Now, I know this is going to get just a little bit on thin ice, but I suggest it to you. Many of us are teachers. We've had a need for teachers in our own home communities. And we're still struggling for that. You don't have any idea how many calls we get here kind of on a weekly basis about this time of the year for people, communities who are needing teachers. Right, Milo? Lots of. So we need teachers in our home communities. And I want to underscore that. That's terrific. And I want to tell you, there's hardly any place in the community where you can get yourself right down into the warp and woof of what's happening in our families than if you teach in a school. I want to encourage the teaching thing. And I want to even be bold enough to extend it just a little bit beyond our communities. I want to suggest to you that there is a possibility that this is a place for us to stand on the world scene. And I don't want to brag or anything like that, but I just want to tell you, we have some very, very fine young men and young ladies who are very, very fine teachers, and I wouldn't be afraid to put them in the public forum anywhere and stand them up against teachers, other teachers, and say they will do as well or better in that forum. And my suggestion is that perhaps There is a place for this. As some of you know, we currently have a number of teachers over in Poland teaching English in the public schools there as a means of being in the country and also as establishing contacts and doing mission work. It's amazing. They actually pay you to do the work. And it seems to me as though this should be exploited. I hate to use the word exploited, but why not? They're going to pay you to do it. You can do a good job at it. Why shouldn't you? And I just wonder, I'm just beginning to dream more and more and more about the possibilities here. And what a place to contact the world. What a place to speak into this world and say something to it. And I just want to urge us to continue to dream on this side. I am not so much saying that this is what we need to do, as to saying, listen, let's not shut our eyes. We are in transition now. It's happening. And if we're not thoughtful about it, and if we're not thinking about it, it will just happen in various ways. This will happen, and that will happen, and the other thing will happen, and then we'll wake up so many years later and maybe see another crack in a ship and see the thing sinking because we were not paying attention to what was happening. And notice, I want to keep the connection here. Whatever happens here, it cannot be at the expense of family structure. It simply cannot be. The third thing that I want to bring to your attention is the word friendship. Perhaps a word that comes closer is the word community, but I wanted to maintain the alliteration, and so I used family, farm, and friendship so that you could perhaps remember it. We've heard a lot of talk about non-resistance. One of the things that our communities have been known for worldwide is its sense of community. This was brought home to me one time when I was discussing with a person the issue of insurance, and I was, I kind of frown on this insurance and that insurance and making sure this happens and that happens. And after some discussion, this is a non-Mennonite person, after some discussion he said, oh, but I see, your insurance is your community. And he meant to get me with that. They say, don't tell me you don't have insurance, it's your community. I said, but friend, you're exactly right, but that's the kind of insurance that God intends for us to have in Christian community. Now, he saw that in us, and he said, there is something strong there about the kind of friendship and community that is exhibited among your folks. And he was bold enough just to simply say, that's your insurance. Well, perhaps he wasn't exactly right on that, but it was a point to consider. Now, this brings us, though, right face to face with all those ships on the water and the few grenades that get flown. He didn't talk about grenades. He didn't have any of those involved. But I think if we don't have our eyes shut, we know that there are a few grenades and cannonballs and bunker busters, I guess is a more common term today, and a few things get thrown around various times in order to kind of make it difficult for ships to stay afloat. Well, of course, that's not the idea, but I don't know what all the ideas are behind it. This question came up yesterday. When I was looking down over the questions that you all brought toward us, wasn't able to ask them all, but I'm going to guess at least 25% of them either hinted at or hit this question directly. What is our problem? Why are we unable to extend this sense of community beyond ourselves? Why is it so stuck right where we're at, kind of like? So we have our little inner circle of friends that we will extend this kind of Christian community to, but somehow we have not learned how to extend beyond that. And that is a very, very live question. And I want to suggest to you, well, this is going to be a strong statement. We either solve this problem or all those ships are going down by and by. You cannot continue with this amazing multiplication and proliferation of groups splintering, particularly if what they're going to do then is get at each other's throat and refuse pulpits to each other and on and on and on and on. There is no way to survive doing that in the long term. It just simply means it's all going down. And wouldn't that be ironic if the things that we built, the structures I'm talking about here, family, farm, and a certain friendship would suddenly be sabotaged by ourselves? Now, wouldn't that be ridiculous if they all went down because we took our grenades and began to fling them at each other, and the ships went down for that reason? We absolutely cannot do that. Well, then what must we do? Take the initiative. Here's a word that I want you to remember. Take the initiative. See, if we all sit in our boats, brother, I can't thank you enough for that little metaphor, that little illustration to use here, because it works so well. If we all sit in our little boats, cowering in fear, getting ready for the next grenade, the next phone call, if you're a bishop in the church, and some of you are here. The next, we're just waiting. Oh boy, the next phone call. The next ministerial meeting. The next this, the next that, and we're just there, can't hardly wait. And we sure hope that when it comes, we can get the shield up in time to throw it off. We will not win that way. This will not work. This, in the end, is just simply wearing us out. It's wearing us down. It's draining us of our energy. And it is utter foolishness. When I say take the initiative, I mean stop worrying about the grenades and get in the boat and rally the troops and start to row. Get going in a direction. Start moving somewhere. And get a few people who have come to know the Lord in very good ways, who are old with gray hair. I have gray hair, but I mind you, I'm not old. Who are old and have gray hair, and send an embassy over to that next boat. And over to the next boat. And over to the next boat. And start working. Take some initiative in achieving a sense of unity in where we're going. Beyond that, I think the initiative calls for us to begin to look at what God has called us to do. See, while we're busy milling around in the ocean and tossing the grenades and wondering how this is all going to turn out and wagging our heads over this sinking ship and that sinking ship and all that, the work of God has stopped. The work of the kingdom has come to an end. And that's the sad thing. There's much work to be done. This is precisely part of our problem. If, in fact, we enjoy the leisurely moments that God has given us in the United States of America, and now I'm going to talk just a little bit about one of our problems, our absolutely outrageously affluent society that we live in. But I don't want you to hear everything negative. That effluency has, in fact, lulled us to sleep. And so while we have been content to sit in our little communities and have our little, like I say sometimes, my little old village and my little old house and my little old wife, and she'll like that, and all my children gathered around me in various ways and just kind of enjoy everything that's sort of coming my way. While all that's happening, I can tell you, as I sit there, after a while, if I don't know what else to do, I'll pick a fight. Guaranteed. After a while, I'll pick a fight. But if I, on the other hand, so hear me right here, I'm not saying that evil days affluences upon us. My dear brothers and sisters, do you realize the moment that we hold in our hands? We don't have to start crying around and acting like then the thing to do is to somehow destroy all that affluence. That's not what I'm calling us to do. I'm saying if you take that stuff to yourself and you live in its leisure and in its and just bask in its sunshine, you will eventually have a desire to pick a fight because we're designed to do something. And as a result, that's probably what we'll end up doing. Rather than doing that, I'm saying take that affluence that God has given us and seize the moment. There has never been, it just frustrates me almost to tears. There has never been a day that I can think of historically. You brothers who are historians should talk about this, I guess. There's never been a day like today. First of all, just in terms of liberty and freedom to move about, our ancestors were under fire. Strung up on ladders that we saw a picture of and various things. So there's nothing like that today in the United States of America. Freedom to move about and do what you jolly well please almost. Not only that, but the infrastructure is in place. You've got money. Do you realize that if you had in the 1930s had called upon our people to produce the kind of money that CAM handles today, I don't know if you could have found it. It just wasn't in existence, I don't think. And I might be wrong in that. Some people challenge that. But from what I read and what my father tells me, it just wasn't there. Today it is. And since it is here today, I'm not ready to stand up here and decry the day and the times. Isn't that from the hand of our sovereign God? If it is, then why don't we use it? And why don't we move with it in good ways and in good directions for the kingdom of God? This is the way I see this. Brother Edsel, I'm still like that term there, that aggresso conservative position, okay? Let's get that aggressive. He said that he's kind of would sort of make the conservative side big maybe or a little bigger and the aggressive side a little small. Well, I know what you meant by that, Brother Edsel. I understand it very well, but on the other side of the coin, don't forget the aggressive side, the movement. We've got work to do. And that work needs to happen, I think. So I have here written in my notes, take the initiative, aggressive peace initiative at home and abroad. At home first. I want to illustrate this yet with what I'm talking about with a real live story to help us understand what we're trying to think about here this morning. I hesitate to use very, very personal illustrations, but this is the one that's the closest to me. I'd just like to give you a little model. I don't consider my model or the model of my family to be anywhere close to perfect, but this is the way Sheila and I have been trying to work at this thing. I already told you, I'm frustrated to tears with the fact. See, if I had my druthers, I'd be farming. I really would. You don't know how much I love the farm. I like the smell of plowed earth this time of the year. I never tell students this, but it drives me crazy. I don't mind teaching school at all when the snow's flying and it's raining like crazy or so. I don't mind that at all. But I tell you what, when you start to smell, I even like the smell of manure. I do. It's I don't know, it's the right smell in the springtime of the year and the that good earth turning over. It's powerfully, powerfully attractive to me. But I've been denied this for whatever reason, it seems, and I'm content with that denial. But I am not content then to let the blessing of that farm life that I tried to show to you go down the tube. There has to be a way. There has to be a way to duplicate it, to do the same thing in other situations. If you cannot do it, then there's something wrong with our message. This is a picture of a church. This is a slide of a church in Poland. This was an old Mennonite church. Its location is up along the Vistula River, or as they say in Polish, the Wisła River. I was not aware that there were Mennonites as far south in Poland, but a good friend of mine by the name of Jan Wierzchowski, who is an old man today, introduced me to this. Our family just last fall was in Poland, and this is when we went to visit this church. There's quite a story here. But just let me tell you a little bit of the burden on my heart here. So I was denied the farm. And the project, the opportunity to work shoulder to shoulder with my sons, on the farm. Although we did some of that a number of years back, as they can tell you, when I was teaching and doing some custom farming back home. Then we began to think to ourselves, but there are other projects just as noble, or perhaps even more noble, on the face of the earth that as a family we can enter into. I'm just giving you a little bit of backdrop here. So a couple of years ago, our oldest son spent a year with three other young men. I believe he was 19 at the time, 19 or 20, I can't quite remember. Spent time in Poland, kind of the vanguard of a group of men during a very, very, very difficult time. When I think about it now, I wonder where we were. We sent four young men over there just by themselves, to a little old cabin, and had them do a little bit of footwork, spying out the land, so to speak, in Poland. It was a difficult time for them. If they stood up, there's a couple of them here this morning, if they stood up and told you the story, they would tell you, I'm not telling you something about a picnic. I mean, we had difficulty and trouble and legal ramifications, and you have no idea what all. I know, these boys were over there sometimes on a winter night in Poland all by themselves, could hardly speak the language. They weren't sure what I felt like they should do or what the rest of the board here felt like they should do. And they weren't sure if they were just wasting their time or what they were doing. Fact of the matter is, I didn't know either. But I knew we needed to press forward. Press forward. Take the initiative. So we kind of kept with the thing. So my oldest son came back along with the rest of these young men who were there. We had a little waiting stage, and then we ended up sending two families back over to Poland. Some of you know them very well, Laverne Hirschberger's and John Schmucker's. John Schmucker, bless his heart, the first time I met him, he was coming to teach school at Anchor. I'm amazed at the sovereignty of God. I remember meeting him just as a young man, 18-year-old, just about as thin as that, and didn't weigh very much. And I think he's going to teach school, sure. So he taught school. Now he's in Poland, heading up the team over there. And then our twins have been over there for a little while, and they're back, and now planning to get married. Point is, the Poland project became a family project. Not just my project, not just me doing this, me doing that, me doing the other thing. You don't have to stand, you don't have to shut off this idea of standing shoulder to shoulder, doing work. Sure, it happens on the farm, but can't it happen a lot of other places? Take the initiative. Take the initiative is the point here. Now this church, when we were in Poland this last time, Jan Wierzchowski said, I want to take you to see some sites. And so we traveled north of Warsaw up along the Wisła River and visited a couple of sites, and this is one of the places. This church is over 200 years old. When some German-speaking Dutch Mennonites, when I say German-speaking Dutch, they came from the Holland area, but eventually moved down south in Poland and settled here just north of Warsaw. As I stood there and looked at this church when we drove up to it, I couldn't help but just go back and picture the days when there were little youngsters, little Mennonite youngsters running out there in that churchyard. Years went by, and they did whatever they did. And to make a long story short, in the 1940s, they spoke German, right? And so following World War II, as the Russian army moved into Poland, they expelled all German-speaking people from Poland, which meant that this place was abandoned. The government confiscated that church and turned it into housing. See the bicycles there? Remember, the communists were going to give houses and land and bread to everybody. Of course, they had their way of doing that. And so for some very poor folks who could not do much of anything else, they would give them churches like this. And so if you walked inside those doors, I couldn't imagine the poverty inside of it. This reminded me of people who would have been going west to Kansas and Oklahoma and so forth back in the days when the land was open. That's what it looks like to me, inside their wash basins and things like that. Divided up, two families live in there, very, very, very poor families. This is what fascinated me. We went in town and talked to the overseer of historical sites, since the Communist Party has fallen out of repute there in Poland, of course. And this is what the man said. He said, I probably could get that property back in the name of the people who owned it before. And if you folks are representatives of the Mennonites who lived there before, chances are you could have this building back. You know what I thought. One other slide of this. Just to underscore my point here, I'll let you hunt around for this young man. He's in this audience. But I took this picture intentionally. I really didn't even think of all the symbolism when I took it. But after I took it, after I saw the picture, I realized some of the thoughts that were going through my mind when I asked this young man to stand up there so I could take his picture. You might notice the shirt tail's out. It looks like a farm boy, doesn't he? Looks like a good German farm boy. Good German stock there. From taking a look there. See how he's got his feet planted? Well, I just want to challenge the young folks and the families here in this community. There is a church. There is a place in Poland. There are perhaps many places around the earth like this, where in fact the opportunity exists. The opportunity exists. And we are very foolish if what we do is turn away from these opportunities. I have a passage to read for you. Isaiah chapter 61. And I'm sorry for some of you, this sounds like a broken record. But I can't get away from the vision that is introduced here in this chapter. You'll recognize it immediately. The passage is typically applied to Jesus Christ in terms of, or as a prophetic passage. I agree with that, but I'm very much aware that we have been called to do the things that he did. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. We've heard a lot about humility this weekend. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives in the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.